Proclamation of 1763 had included one vaguely worded provision, granting 5,000 acres apiece to former officers who had served the cause. The location of the land was never made clear. Washington was relentless in pressing his claims according to these two proclamations. He organized the veterans of the Virginia Regiment and led the political fight in Williamsburg for patents on plots of land bordering the Ohio and Great Kanawha Rivers in what are now southwestern Pennsylvania, southeastern Ohio, and northwestern West Virginia. In the fall of 1770, he personally led an exploratory surveying expedition to the Ohio and Great Kanawha, and the following year commissioned William Crawford, another veteran of the regiment, to complete the survey. He devised a scheme, eventually abandoned, to transport immigrants from Germany as indentured servants who would settle his own plots and thereby deter poachers. When that idea fizzled, he gave orders to purchase 10 white servants, 4 of them convicts in the Baltimore jail, to occupy his land on the Great Kanawha. The total domain he claimed for himself, all choice bottom land, exceeded 20,000 acres. There were two sour notes. The first came from several veterans who believed that Washington's land was too choice, meaning that he had reserved the most fertile acreage bordering the rivers for himself and relegated the other claimants to less valuable plots. Washington effectively admitted the accusation was true, later acknowledging that he had taken the cream of the country. But when one disgruntled veteran confronted him with the charge, it provoked a thunderous rebuke. "As I am not accustomed to receive such from any man, nor would have taken the same language from you personally, all my concerns is that I ever engaged in behalf of so ungrateful and dirty a fellow as you are." As Washington saw it, he was the senior officer of the regiment, who had almost single-handedly managed the entire operation to acquire the land. In effect, he deserved what he took. And everyone who questioned his integrity on any matter involving his own self-interest triggered internal explosions of seismic proportions. The other sour note came from Washington himself. As different governors in Virginia and different ministries in London came and went, different interpretations of British policy toward the American interior also came and went. The core issue was the Proclamation of 1763, which in one version rendered all of Washington's Western claims null and void, all his time and energy wasted, because London had declared that the entire Ohio country was off limits to settlement. Washington, of course, regarded this version of British policy as a massive delusion that was also wholly unenforceable. The British monarch could proclaim whatever he wished, but the practical reality was that thousands of colonial settlers were swarming across the Alleghenies every year, establishing their claims not by any legal appeal to colonial or British authority, but by the physical act of occupying and cultivating the land. What inducements have men to explore uninhabited wilds but the prospect of getting good lands? He asked. Would any man waste his time, expose his fortune, nay, life, in search of this, if he was to share the good and the bad with those that came after him? Surely no. Washington believed there was a race going on for the bounty of half a continent. If he were to play by British rules, which refused to recognize the race was even occurring, others who ignored the rules would claim the bounty. His solution, elegantly simple, was to regard restrictive British policies as superfluous, and to act on the assumption that, in the end, no one could stop him. Several biographers have looked upon this extended episode of land acquisitions as an unseemly and perhaps uncharacteristic display of personal avarice, mostly because they are judging Washington against his later and legendary reputation for self-denial, or against some modern guilt-driven standard for treatment of Native Americans. In fact, Washington's avid pursuit of acreage, like his attitude toward slavery, was rather typical of Virginia's planter class. He was simply more diligent in his quest than most. And his resolutely realistic assessment of the Indians' eventual fate was part and parcel of his instinctive aversion to sentimentalism and all moralistic brands of idealism, an instinct that deservedly won plaudits in later contexts, as disappointing as it was in this one. Two more telling and less judgmental points have greater resonance for our understanding of the different ingredients that would shape Washington's character. The first is that he retained his youthful conviction that careers, fortunes, and the decisive developments in America's future lay in the West, on a continental stage so large and unexplored that no one fully fathomed its potential. This was a prize worth fighting for. The second is that the interest of the American colonies and the interest of the British Empire, so long presumed to be overlapping, were in fact mutually exclusive on this seminal issue. Constitutional niceties did not concern him. The more elemental reality was that the colonies needed to expand and grow, and the British government was determined to block that expansion and stifle that growth. Once again, there was a personal edge to that conviction. In 1774, Washington learned that Earl Hillsborough, Secretary of State for the American colonies, had ruled that land grants to veterans of the French and Indian War, promised in the Proclamation of 1763, would be restricted to British regulars. Washington greeted the news with contempt. "I conceive the services of a provincial officer as worthy of reward as a regular one," he observed, "and can only be withheld from him with injustice." And since Hillsborough's decision was, as he put it, founded equally in malice, absurdity, and error, Washington felt no obligation to obey it. As far as the American West was concerned, he was already declaring his independence. A last resort. If one were searching for early glimmerings of a broader belief in American independence, Washington's remarks about the Stamp Act, a clear and unequivocal denial of Parliament's authority to tax the colonies without their consent, might be offered up as evidence of his prescient premonitions as early as 1765. Such selective readings distort the larger pattern, however, which suggests that neither Washington nor any other colonist was thinking seriously about seceding from the British Empire at this early stage. Washington expressed his relief that the British government had come to its senses, in part because of pressure from merchants like Robert Carey, and repealed the Stamp Act in 1766. He seemed unconcerned about the lingering constitutional question of Parliament's authority, presumably believing that as long as it remained theoretical, it could and would be completely ignored. "All, therefore, who were instrumental in procuring the repeal," he wrote Carey, "are entitled to the thanks of every British subject." He still considered himself such a creature. The wave, it seemed, had passed safely under the ship. For the next 3 years, from 1766 to 1769, Washington's mind remained focused on more proximate and pressing problems: cultivating his new wheat crop, worrying about Patsy's health, lobbying in Williamsburg for the bounty lands in the Ohio country. He was not even present at the session of the House of Burgesses in April 1768 when the delegates protested the Townshend Act, a clever, ultimately too clever, measure imposing new duties on colonial imports, which the British ministry claimed were not, strictly speaking, taxes. Over the next year, he did not participate in the public debate that raged in Virginia and that produced non-importation schemes in Massachusetts and New York. Then, in April 1769, he entered the debate in a major and quite distinctive way. In a letter to George Mason, his neighbor down the road at Gunston Hall, Washington began to use the language of a prospective revolutionary. "At a time when our lordly masters in Great Britain will be satisfied with nothing less than the deprivation of American freedom," he wrote, "it seems highly necessary that something should be done to avert the stroke and maintain the liberty which we have derived from our ancestors." Petitions and remonstrances to the king or parliament, he believed, were ineffectual. They had been tried before without success. And their plaintive character irritated Washington, because it seemed to reinforce the sense of subordination and subservience the colonists were protesting against, and that he found so personally offensive. The only sensible course, he argued, was a comprehensive program of non-importation that, by starving their trade and manufacturers, would exert pressure on the British government to alter its course, as it had done after the Stamp Act. But if the lordly masters in Great Britain persisted in their imperious policies, and here, for the first time, Washington did glimpse the future, then the two sides were on a collision course that could only end in war, which he called a dernier resort, a last resort. Then he added a revealing corollary, very much rooted in his own experience with Carey and Company: "That many families are reduced almost, if not quite, to penury and want from the low ebb of their fortunes, and estates selling for the discharge of debts, the public papers furnish but too many melancholy proofs of. And that a scheme of this sort, that is, non-importation, will contribute more effectually than any other I can devise to emerge, that is, remove the country from the distress it at present labors under, I do most firmly believe it can be generally adopted." In other words, a collective decision to stop purchasing British commodities would enforce a level of discipline and austerity on the Virginia planter elite that most of its members, and truth be known, he himself, had shown themselves unable to enforce voluntarily. While such a scheme risked a collision course with the British Empire, it reduced the risk that so many Virginia planters were running of remaining on a collision course with bankruptcy. Washington was not just drawing on his own deep contempt toward English presumptions of superiority. He was also urging Virginians to embrace the same economic self-sufficiency he had decided to implement at Mount Vernon. This was the moment when Washington first began to link the hard-earned lessons that shaped his own personality to the larger cause of American independence. It was also the occasion when Washington first played a leadership role in the House of Burgesses on an issue that transcended local election disputes or veterans' claims. On May 18, 1769, he presented the proposal calling for a colony-wide boycott of enumerated English manufactured goods, to include a cessation of the slave trade. George Mason had actually drafted the proposal, but he could not present it himself because his long-standing reluctance to leave the secure confines of Gunston Hall meant that he refused to stand for election to the House of Burgesses. This was an important moment in Washington's public career, for he now became an acknowledged leader in the resistance movement within Virginia's planter class. Back at Mount Vernon in July, he wrote to Carey, ordering only a few new items, saying that he intended to observe the terms of the boycott religiously, but giving Carey final approval, oddly enough, of what to include or exclude. There was then, in the strange way that history happens, a 5-year hiatus. Though Washington himself observed the terms of the boycott religiously, as he put it again to Carey, the Virginia Association proved as difficult to enforce as Great Britain had found the mercantile empire to regulate. Most importantly, Parliament had repeated its backpedaling pattern after the Stamp Act, this time disavowing all the Townsend duties except the one on tea, it being intended to remain as the principal symbol of British authority. Most observers, Washington included, believed that the wave had once again passed under the ship. The next surge began in the summer of 1774. In response to parliamentary legislation, the colonists called the Intolerable Acts, which closed Boston's port and imposed martial law on Massachusetts as punishment for the orchestrated riot that came to be called the Boston Tea Party. Writing to George William Fairfax, who had moved back to England with Sally the previous year, Washington vowed that the cause of Boston ever will be considered as the cause of America, not that we approve their conduct in destroying the tea. The escalation of British repression produced an equally dramatic escalation in Washington's thinking, or at least in the language he used to characterize British policy. In addition to his familiar themes, petitions were worse than worthless, abstract arguments must be accompanied by economic pressures, now he detected a full-blooded conspiracy against American liberty. "Does it not appear," he asked rhetorically, "as clear as the sun in its meridian brightness, that there is a regular, systematic plan formed to fix the right and practice of taxation upon us?" In a long letter to Bryan Fairfax, George William's half-brother, he repeated the conspiracy charge, then added the provocative argument that unless the colonies stood together against this challenge, Great Britain would make us as tame and abject slaves as the blacks we rule over with such arbitrary sway. The slavery analogy is startling, both because of its stark depiction of the power emanating from London, and because its potency and credibility grew directly out of Washington's personal familiarity with the exercise of just such power over his own slaves. During the American Revolution, several English commentators called attention to the hypocrisy of slave owners wrapping their cause in the rhetoric of liberty. In Washington's case, the rhetoric was heartfelt precisely because he understood firsthand the limitless opportunity for abuse once control was vested in another. He did not see himself as a hypocrite so much as a man determined to prevent the cruel ways of history from happening to him. His belief that a British conspiracy was afoot serves as an almost textbook example of the radical Whig ideology that historians have made the central feature of scholarship on the American Revolution for the past 40 years. These historians have discovered a cluster of ideas about the irreconcilable tension between liberty and power that English dissenters called the Country Party hurled at the Hanoverian court, and the inordinately long-standing ministry of Robert Walpole in the middle third of the 18th century. There is now a well-established consensus that many prominent American revolutionary thinkers, including John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, and George Mason, were familiar with the writings of such English Whigs as John Trenchard, Thomas Gordon, and Viscount Bolingbroke, and that their response to Parliament's legislative initiative in the 1760s was at least partially shaped by what they read about the inherently corrupt and conniving character of British government as depicted by the Country Party. There is some reason to believe that Washington's political vocabulary grew in this more radical direction because of increased interaction with Mason in the summer of 1774. Mason was generally regarded as Virginia's most learned student of political theory, well-versed in all the Whig writers. He and Washington conferred several times in July, as Mason was drafting the Fairfax Resolves, which also warned of a concerted British plan to make all colonists into slaves and imposed the dramatic dichotomy of English corruption and American virtue over all its recommendations. Washington actually chaired the meeting in Alexandria where the Fairfax Resolves were adopted. The most important recommendation was for convening a Continental Congress to approve a comprehensive boycott of British imports. Washington's escalating rhetoric, in short, probably reflected the intensive collaboration with Mason, who provided him with instruction on the language of radical Whig ideology. Interestingly, Washington himself acknowledged that he was an unsophisticated student of history and English politics, and that much abler heads than my own hath fully convinced me that it, that is, current British policy, is not only repugnant to natural right, but subversive of the laws and constitution of Great Britain itself. But he placed the emphasis for his radical evolution elsewhere, indeed, inside himself. "An innate spirit of freedom first told me," he explained, "that the measures which the administration hath for some time been and now are most violently pursuing are repugnant to every principle of natural justice." While we cannot know, at least in the fullest and deepest sense, where that voice inside himself originated, it does seem to echo the resentful voice of the young colonel in the Virginia regiment, bristling at the condescending ignorance of Lord Loudon and the casual rejection of his request for a regular commission in the British Army. It harks back to the voice of the master of Mount Vernon, lured by Carey and company, and, truth be told, his own urge to replicate the lifestyle of an English country gentleman, into a mercantile system apparently designed to entrap him in a spiraling network of debt. Indeed, less than a year earlier, in November 1773, when he had instructed Carey to pay off the remainder of his debt with funds from Patsy's inheritance, Carey had refused, correctly claiming that the two accounts were not transferable. The voice also resonates with the same outraged frustration he felt whenever some distant and faceless British official, the most recent version of the vile breed being the Earl of Hillsborough, blocked his claim for Western lands, allegedly to protect Indian rights, but more probably, he believed, to reserve the land for London cronies. All of which is to suggest that Washington did not need to read books by radical Whig writers or receive an education in political theory from George Mason in order to regard the British military occupation of Massachusetts in 1774 as the latest installment in a long-standing pattern. His own ideological origins did not derive primarily from books, but from his own experience with what he had come to regard as the imperiousness of the British Empire. Mason probably helped him to develop a more expansive vocabulary to express his thoughts and feelings, but the thoughts, and even more so the feelings, had been brewing inside him for more than 20 years. At the psychological nub of it all lay an utter loathing for any form of dependency, a sense of his own significance, and a deep distrust of any authority beyond his direct control. He spent the first week of August in Williamsburg at the Virginia Convention, called to select 7 delegates to the Continental Congress. When all the votes were counted, he came in 3rd, just behind Richard Henry Lee and comfortably ahead of Patrick Henry. The vote was a measure of his growing stature as a stalwart, cool-headed leader of the protest movement in Virginia. As one of his ablest biographers put it, his fellow Burgesses knew that Henry could be counted on to say the magnificent thing, whereas Washington could be counted on to say little, but do the right thing. Off he then went to Philadelphia, where he performed according to form, silent during the debates, but thoroughly dedicated to opposing the intolerable acts and supporting a rigorous Continental Association against British imports. While in Philadelphia, he received a letter from Robert Mackenzie, a veteran of the Virginia Regiment, who had subsequently obtained a commission in the British Army, warning him that the colonial cause was hopeless, that all the best characters were on the other side. Since Washington regarded himself as a charter member of that exclusive club, he diplomatically questioned Mackenzie's assessment, then offered his own best guess at where history was headed. "More blood will be spilt on this occasion, if the ministry are determined to push matters to an extremity, than history has ever yet furnished instances of in the annals of North America." Before he left town, he purchased a new sash and epaulets for his military uniform, inquired about the price of muskets, and ordered a book by Thomas Webb entitled A Military Treatise on the Appointments of the Army. Though he still hoped it could be avoided, he was preparing for the last resort. The Self-Evident Exception. Once back at Mount Vernon, his mind moved along 2 separate tracks. While a political crisis of enormous magnitude was obviously in the air, there had been crises before, and each time the British government had stepped back from the precipice. Although newspaper reports were hardly encouraging, with some suggesting that George III had ordered his European ambassadors to regard the American colonies as already in a state of rebellion, Washington remained cautiously optimistic that cooler heads in London would again prevail. "There is reason to believe," he explained in February 1775, "that the ministry would willingly change their ground from a conviction the forcible measures will be inadequate to the end designed." Now, at any rate, was not the time for rash or provocative decisions. "A little time must now unfold the mystery," he cautioned, "as matters are drawing to a point." Washington chose to use that time to recover familiar rhythms. He chaired meetings of the Potomac Company, where 50 Negro men were hired to dredge the upper reaches of the river. He He worked extensively on settling business associated with the now empty Fairfax estate at Belvoir. He outfitted a new expedition to occupy and develop his large tract of land on the Great Kanawha. This despite the fact that Lord Dunmore, the new governor of Virginia, apprised him that all his surveys of the land in the Ohio country had been voided. Even more defiantly, he decided to go forward with another major renovation of Mount Vernon, the one that gave the mansion the size and style we recognize today. The decisions to pursue his land claims and renovate Mount Vernon on the cusp of an imperial crisis seemed to suggest more than a guarded hope that the crisis would pass. They constitute a personal statement that his own agenda would not be dictated by men he had contemptuously described as those lordly masters in Great Britain. The other track, just the opposite of his defiant recovery of routine, led toward war and what turned out to be destiny. During the winter and spring of 1775, county militia units, calling themselves independent companies, were being organized throughout the colony. As Virginia's most famous war hero, Washington was the obvious choice as commander. And by March, five independent companies had invited him to lead them. Also in March, a second Virginia convention was called, this time in Richmond, and ordered that the colony be immediately put into a posture of defense. This was the occasion when Patrick Henry gave his famous Liberty or Death speech, but it also marked the moment when military preparation replaced political argumentation in Virginia as the highest priority. With that change, Washington succeeded orators like Henry as the most crucial figure. In the balloting to select delegates to the Second Continental Congress, he received 106 of the 108 votes cast. Throughout April and May, Mount Vernon became the unofficial headquarters for planning Virginia's response to the burgeoning crisis, and Washington became the acknowledged central player. One small event captured the headiness of the times, as well as Washington's emerging role as the singular, soon-to-become-transcendent leader. Mason had drafted a proposal for the Fairfax Independent Company, recommending that all officers be elected annually and rotate between officer and enlisted status on a regular basis. The notion that an army should be organized democratically was a truly radical suggestion, and one that Washington himself regarded as ridiculous. But Mason coupled his proposal with a corollary designed to disarm critics who doubted that such an arrangement could ever work. Namely, that Washington would be the exception to the rotation principle, thereby providing the enduring stability required. As Mason put it, the exception made in favor of the gentleman who by the unanimous vote of the company now commands it is a very proper one, justly due to his public merit and experience, particularly suited to our circumstances, as was dictated not by compliment but conviction. It was a prophetic premonition of Washington's abiding role throughout his subsequent career as the elite exception that proved the egalitarian rule. The late spring of 1775 was an intense time for both American independence and the public career of George Washington. A crowded moment, when a great deal of history happened quickly, when events dictated decisions that in turn determined the direction of an emerging nation and the character of its preeminent hero. For all those reasons, this is an extended moment worth lingering over, searching through the dizzying details of the story for at least the outline of answers to the three most salient questions. First, When did Washington conclude that war with Great Britain was inevitable? Second, how and why was Washington singled out to lead what soon became known as the Continental Army? And third, what was Washington's response, not just publicly but personally, to this assignment? The answer to the first question is reasonably, if not perfectly, clear. When the British troops occupied Boston in 1774, Washington believed an important line had been crossed. After that date, war became a distinct possibility that could only be avoided if the British ministry altered its course. Over the course of the following year, as the evidence mounted that George III and his ministers fully intended to make Massachusetts an object lesson of where sovereign power resided within the British Empire, Washington believed that war had become a probability. When he departed Mount Vernon for Philadelphia on May 4, 1775, he took along his military uniform, both a sign and a statement of his aggressive intentions. But the truly clinching evidence came in mid-May, when reliable news of the actions at Lexington and Concord reached Philadelphia, along with reports from London that a major British force was on the way to support General Thomas Gage's beleaguered garrison in Boston. As he wrote to George William Fairfax in London, Washington's mind was made up. "Unhappy it is, though, to reflect that a brother's sword has been sheathed in a brother's breast, and that the once happy and peaceful plains of America are either to be drenched with blood or inhabited by slaves. Sad alternative. But can a virtuous man hesitate in this choice?" His cash accounts for early June show purchases of a tomahawk, several cartouche boxes, new coverings for his holsters, and 5 books on the military art. He was preparing to go to war. But how was he selected to lead the entire American army? That question has provoked a lively debate across several generations of biographers and historians. In his autobiographical recollection of the decision, John Adams claimed the lion's share of credit for choosing Washington, suggesting that he overruled the New England delegation in the Continental Congress, which had presumed that one of their own would be chosen because the current battle was raging around Boston. Adams's claim is almost surely a self-serving piece of mischief designed to exaggerate his own influence. It obscures the more elemental fact that once the members of the Congress realized that they were facing a military as well as political crisis, the selection of Washington as the military commander was a foregone conclusion. In fact, at that confused and highly improvisational moment within the Congress, more delegates could agree that Washington should lead the American army than that there should be an American army at all. His unanimous elevation to the position as commander-in-chief actually preceded the creation of a national military force that he could command. Why did the choice seem so obvious? The short answer is that the appointment of a Virginian was politically essential in order to assure the allegiance of the most populous and wealthiest colony to the cause, and Washington was unquestionably the most eligible and qualified Virginian. Another short answer, subsequently offered by Adams as a joke, was that Washington was always selected by deliberative bodies to lead, whatever the cause, because he was always the tallest man in the room. Even as a joke, however, Adams was making a serious point that a veritable legion of his contemporaries made, especially upon first meeting Washington, namely, that he was physically majestic. As Benjamin Rush, the Philadelphia physician and staunch revolutionary, put it, "He had so much martial dignity in his deportment that you would distinguish him to be a general and a soldier from among 10,000 people." First impressions and appearances are often described as misleading, but in Washington's case they establish the favorable initial context for all subsequent judgments. In the highly charged atmosphere of the Continental Congress, where nervous men, all prominent figures in their own respective colonies, tended to talk too much, Washington's sheer physicality made his reserve and customary silence into a sign of strength and sagacity. Looking backward from June 1775, with all the advantage of hindsight, one can see it coming. During the sessions of the Congress in May, Washington was the only delegate to attend in military uniform and was asked to chair four committees charged with military readiness. In the first Continental Congress, he had been given no committee assignments at all. When he approached Philadelphia in his custom-built chariot in early May, a throng of 500 riders escorted him into the city, a tribute accorded no other delegate. Nearly a year earlier, at the first Continental Congress, he had been the beneficiary of a widely circulated rumor that Adams recorded in his diary. "Colonel Washington made the most eloquent speech at the Virginia Convention that ever was made. Says he, 'I will raise 1,000 men, subsist them at my own expense, and march myself at their head for the relief of Boston.'" This was a complete fabrication. Washington had made no such speech. In fact, had made no speech at all. But the mythology was already starting to build, as the need intensified for a symbol of intercolonial unity who could consolidate the disparate and even chaotic response of 13 different colonies to the British military threat. He satisfied the requirements visually and politically more completely than anyone else. Finally, what was going on inside Washington's own mind and heart? His diary entries for June 15th and June 16th, respectively the day he was appointed and the day he delivered his brief acceptance speech to Congress, are characteristically unhelpful, telling us only where he dined and spent his evenings. The speech itself makes two distinctive points: that he did not feel qualified for the position, and that he would serve without pay. Here is the most revealing passage. "But lest some unlucky event should happen unfavorable to my reputation, I beg it may be remembered by every gentleman in the room that I this day declare with the utmost sincerity I do not think myself equal to the command I am honored with." One is tempted to read this kind of public modesty with a skeptical eye, as a ritualized statement of humility designed to demonstrate gentlemanly etiquette, rather than as a candid expression of what he truly felt. After all, Washington had been talked about as the leading candidate for the job of military commander for several weeks, had done nothing to discourage such talk, and had been wearing his uniform as a rather conspicuous statement of his candidacy. But in his private correspondence to his wife and brother, Washington also described his appointment as "a trust too great for my capacity," and even claimed that he had done everything in his power to avoid it. He said much the same thing to his brother-in-law, Burwell Bassett. "I am now embarked on a tempestuous ocean, from whence perhaps no friendly harbor is to be found. It is an honor I wished to avoid. I can answer but for three things: a firm belief of the justice of our cause, close attention to the prosecution of it, and the strictest integrity. If these, cannot supply the places of ability and experience, the cause will suffer, and more than probably my character along with it, as reputation derives its principal support from success. What, then, is going on here? It helps to recognize that Washington engaged in the same pattern of postured reticence on two subsequent occasions, when he agreed to chair the Constitutional Convention and when he accepted the office of the presidency. In all three instances, he denied any interest in the appointment, demeaned his own qualifications, and insisted that only a unanimous vote left him no choice but to accept the call. The pattern suggests he had considerable trouble acknowledging his own ambitions. His claim that he had no interest in the commander-in-chief post was not so much a lie as an essential fabrication that shielded him from the recognition that within a Continental Congress filled with ambitious delegates, he was the most ambitious, not just the tallest, man in the room. He needed to convince himself that the summons came from outside rather than inside his own soul. If Washington was playing hide-and-seek within himself on the question of his own ambition, he was being honest and realistic about his qualifications to lead the American army to victory. Though a battle-tested veteran, he had never commanded any unit larger than a regiment. He had no experience deploying artillery or maneuvering cavalry, and no background whatsoever in the engineering skills required to construct defensive positions or conduct sieges. Compared to the British officers he was sure to face on the battlefield, he was a rank amateur. We do not know the specific titles of the military books he purchased before departing Philadelphia, but they represented his effort to teach himself how to organize an army. The misgivings he expressed in the wake of his appointment, then, were not affectations of false humility, but rather rigorously realistic assessments during an intense moment of self-evaluation in which he was mercilessly honest about his prospects for success. While everyone around him was caught up in patriotic declarations about the moral supremacy of the American cause, Washington remained immune to the inflated rhetoric, keenly aware that a fervent belief in the worthiness of a crusade was no guarantee of its ultimate triumph. And he was right. For the larger truth was that no one was qualified to lead an American army to victory because the odds against such an outcome appeared overwhelming. No matter how glorious the cause, the prospects of 13 disparate and contentious colonies defeating the most powerful army and navy in the world were remote in the extreme. It would take almost exactly a year before Thomas Jefferson would draft the document in which the delegates in the Continental Congress pledged our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor on behalf of American independence. Washington fully recognized that by accepting the appointment as commander-in-chief, he was making a personal pledge before anyone else. And if he failed in the high-stakes gamble, his Mount Vernon estate would be confiscated, his name would become a slur throughout the land, and his own neck would almost surely be stretched. If the decision to marry Martha Custis most shaped his own life, the decision to take command of the Continental Army most shaped his place in history. He made it with his eyes open, with a realistic sense of how much was at stake, and with a keen appreciation of what he was up against. In late June, as he was preparing to leave Philadelphia, his thoughts turned momentarily to those lands on the Great Kanawha which royal officials were attempting to deny him. if the military campaign floundered at the start, and he was able to avoid capture, that was the place to which he would flee, taking with him as many troops as he could salvage, holding out as a guerrilla band in wilderness terrain he knew so well and that no British army could conquer. If he was looking for omens, the first one was not encouraging. He assumed command of 16,000 militia outside Boston on July 3, 1775, the 21st anniversary of his ignominious defeat at Fort Necessity. This time, he could not afford to lose. Chapter 3, First in War. Although there was no way he could have known it at the time, Washington was assuming command of the army in the longest declared war in American history. He was 43 years old when he rode out of Mount Vernon toward Philadelphia. He was 51 when he arrived back at Mount Vernon on Christmas Eve, 1783, the most famous man in the world. He started his odyssey with the presumption that he was fighting a war for American independence, nothing more and nothing less. He ended it with the realization that the war for independence had become the American Revolution, which is to say that the cause he headed had not only smashed two British armies and destroyed the first British Empire, it had also set in motion a political movement committed to principles that were destined to topple the monarchical and aristocratic dynasties of the Old World. The American Revolution was the central event in Washington's life, the crucible for his development as a mature man, a prominent statesman, and a national hero. And while zealous students of the Civil War might contest the claim, the movement that Washington found himself heading was also the most consequential event in American history, the crucible within which the political personality of the United States took shape. In effect, the character of the man and the character of the nation congealed and grew together during an extended moment of 8 years. Washington was not clairvoyant about history's next destination, but he did realize from the start that wherever history was headed, he and America were going there together. With only a few exceptions, his conferences with the Continental Congress and his stopover at Mount Vernon on the way to Yorktown in the fall of 1781, Washington spent the entire war in the field with the Continental Army. He was not, by any standard, a military genius. He lost more battles than he won. Indeed, he lost more battles than any victorious general in modern history. Moreover, his defeats were frequently a function of his own overconfident and aggressive personality, especially during the early stages of the war, when he escaped to fight another day only because the British generals opposing him seemed choked with the kind of caution that, given his resources, Washington should have adopted as his own strategy. But in addition to being fortunate in his adversaries, he was blessed with personal qualities that counted most in a protracted war. He was composed, indefatigable, and able to learn from his mistakes. He was convinced that he was on the side of destiny, or, in more arrogant moments, sure that destiny was on his side. Even his critics acknowledged that he could not be bribed, corrupted, or compromised. Based on his bravery during several battles, he apparently believed he could not be killed. Despite all his mistakes, events seemed to align themselves with his own instincts. He began the war at the Siege of Boston, determined to deliver a decisive blow against more disciplined and battle-tested British regulars. He ended it at the Siege of Yorktown, doing precisely that. One incident near the end of the war provides a clue to the transformation in his character wrought by the intense experience of serving so long as the singular embodiment of commitment to the cause. In 1781, Lund Washington reported that a British warship had anchored in the Potomac near Mount Vernon, presumably with orders to ravage Washington's estate. When the British captain offered assurances that he harbored no hostile intentions, Lund sent out a boatload of provisions to express his gratitude for the captain's admirable restraint. When Washington learned of this incident, he berated Lund. "It would have been a less painful circumstance to me to have heard that, in consequence of your non-compliance with their request, they had burnt my house and laid the plantation in ruins." The estate he had spent so long building now paled in comparison to the reputation earned as the primal symbol of American independence. Lund Washington was protecting the interest of the fox-hunting Virginia squire who had gone off to war. But that man, Washington was at pains to explain, had grown into something else. Cambridge Previews. The story of the Siege of Boston can be told in one sentence. Washington's makeshift army kept more than 10,000 British troops bottled up in the city for over 9 months, at which point the British sailed away to Halifax. Less a battle than a marathon staring match, the conflict exposed the anomalous political circumstance created by the Continental Congress, which was prepared to initiate a war a full year before it was ready to declare American independence. Although Washington subsequently claimed that he knew by the early fall of 1775 that George III was determined to pursue a military rather than a political solution to the imperial crisis, he went along with prevalent fiction that the British garrison in Boston contained ministerial troops, meaning that they did not represent the king's wishes so much as the policy of his evil and misguided ministers. And although he eventually expressed his frustration with the moderate faction in the Continental Congress, who were still feeding themselves upon the dainty food of reconciliation, Washington also recognized that the radical faction, led by John Adams, needed to exhaust all the diplomatic alternatives and patiently wait for public opinion outside New England to mobilize around the novel notion of American independence. But if the Siege of Boston was more an anomalous preliminary than the main event, it was also Washington's debut as Commander-in-Chief. Here, for the first time, he encountered the logistical challenges he would face during the ensuing years of the war. He met many of the men who would comprise his general staff for the duration. And here he demonstrated both the strategic instincts and the leadership skills that would sustain him, and sometimes lead him astray, until the glorious end. The Cambridge encampment, then, was a preview of some tumultuous coming attractions. Events of enduring significance occurred before Washington arrived at Cambridge. On June 17, 1775, about 2,200 British troops made three frontal assaults on New England militia units entrenched on Breed's Hill. Later misnamed the Battle of Bunker Hill, the fight was a tactical victory for the British, but at the frightful cost of more than 1,000 casualties, nearly half the attacking force. When word of the battle reached London, Several British officers observed caustically that a few more such victories and the entire British army would be annihilated. On the American side, Bunker Hill was regarded as a great moral triumph that reinforced the lesson of Lexington and Concord, namely, that militia volunteers fighting for a cause they freely embraced could defeat disciplined British mercenaries. Several newspaper stories made the connection between Braddock's defeat at the Monongahela and Bunker Hill, which seemed to suggest that the very man who had once rescued the Redcoats could now lead inspired American amateurs to a quick and easy victory by mobilizing their superior virtue against plodding professionals. Two seductive illusions were converging here. The first was the perennial belief harbored by both sides at the start of most wars that the conflict would be short. The second, which became the central myth of American military history, was that militia volunteers fighting for principle made better soldiers than trained professionals. Washington was not completely immune to the first illusion, though his version of a quick American victory depended on the willingness of Commander Gage's replacement, General William Howe, to commit his force in a decisive battle outside Boston in a repeat of the Bunker Hill scenario, which would then prompt the King's ministers to propose acceptable terms for peace. Neither Howe nor the British ministry was prepared to cooperate along these lines, and since the only acceptable peace terms on the American side, independence of Parliament's authority, was at this stage non-negotiable on the British side, even Washington's narrow hope had no realistic prospects. Washington was thoroughly immune to the second illusion about the innate superiority of militia. Based on his earlier experience as commander of the Virginia Regiment, reinforced by what he witnessed on a day-to-day basis at his Cambridge encampment, he became convinced that an army of short-term volunteers, no matter how dedicated to the cause, could not win the war. "To expect, then, the same service from raw and undisciplined recruits as from veteran soldiers," he explained, "is to expect